KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Jason McLennan, CEO of both the Cascadia Green Building Council and the International Living Building Institute. A nationally recognized leader in the sustainable building industry, Jason is author of The Living Building Challenge. His work in the sustainable design field has been published in a number of journals, and he is the author of several books, including The Philosophy of Sustainable Design and The Ecological Engineer. Jason McLennan is here today to tell us about the Living Building Challenge and how it can contribute to a more sustainable future. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What led you to create the Living Building Challenge? Why was the Living Building Challenge developed?
Well, my background is in architecture, and I've been a practicing professional for many years and part of the green building movement for some time. And I was kind of frustrated by the lack of progress that our movement was making in terms of really lowering our environmental impact. And the Living Building Challenge was written really to help provide kind of an endgame solution. Here's where we need to head, a lighthouse, if you will, to help us move the building industry in terms of energy efficiency, water efficiency, etc., towards a more truly sustainable place.
Would you give an overview of the Living Building Challenge? What is it exactly?
Sure. The Living Building Challenge is a green building program. Again, it's a challenge to the whole building industry to build to a higher level of performance than currently seen with other green building programs. So project teams that register try to meet a series of requirements or performance requirements that we've set. And if they do that, then they are a certified living building.
Would you elaborate on the goals of the Living Building Challenge?
Sure. Well, again, we're trying to move the whole building industry to a much higher level of environmental performance. So projects that pursue the Living Building Challenge are trying to get net zero energy for energy solutions. So all of their energy is generated on site with solar or wind. They're trying to achieve net zero water so the buildings capture all the water they need from available precipitation. They use the water multiple times in the building, treating it without chemicals. And the building is essentially non-toxic through its specifications. And there's other things, but those are the ones that are easiest to quickly describe. And in other words, these buildings are the greenest buildings on the planet.
Would you go into some detail about how a living building would address issues of climate change?
Well, as I mentioned, net zero energy is the requirement for the energy side. So there's no fossil fuels being consumed at any point during the operation of a living building. The other way we deal with climate change has to do with the energy that's embodied in the construction of the building. And so we actually have the project teams use carbon calculators to determine the approximate carbon footprint, if you will, of the building construction, and then they actually have to purchase offsets for that. So we deal with carbon both in the upstream phase, as we call it, and the downstream phase. So these are carbon neutral buildings through their whole life cycle.
I understand that the challenge also addresses sprawl. Would you like to comment on that, which also, of course, is important for climate change?
Absolutely, yeah. And there, we actually deal with climate change and other environmental issues in sort of multiple integrated ways. And so that's a great point to bring up, that sprawl and where a building is located is obviously a huge issue. And so we actually have a policy of no new sites. And this is a pretty radical stance to take in the development business, if you can imagine. What we're basically saying is that as a species, we've co-opted enough land. And at some point, we have to draw a boundary around our communities and say that that's enough. And so we have a policy where the projects may only be built on previously developed sites, either grayfield sites or brownfield sites, former industrial sites. And if you look at most communities in the U.S., there are plenty of sites that are either underdeveloped, poorly developed, or maybe are not at their highest and best use, or they're existing buildings that should be renovated and reused. So there's a lot of opportunities to build in our cities without further expanding. We want farmland to remain farmland, forest land remaining forest land, and having higher density that is productive in our cities.
I noted in some of the material on your website that equity was listed as one of your standards as well. Would you like to tell us about what's entailed with equity?
Yeah, you know, equity is an issue that the building industry hasn't dealt with very well. And the same could be said for green building in general. So it's an area where we felt like we needed to begin to explore how the decisions we make to design and build our buildings affect people of all backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds. And so while we don't think we have it all figured out, we have requirements in the program for issues of equity. And certainly this does relate to what materials are specified in a building. In other words, where do they come from? How are they made? What are the conditions upon which people who are working in these factories, what conditions are they subjected to? And also in terms of materials, what are the impacts at the end of a life of a material? Usually our materials that go to a landfill, they have chemicals that find their way into local groundwater supplies, or they impact communities. And it's often low-income communities that are near the places where our materials end up. There's also issues of equity in terms of universal access. And so we have to get into issues of making sure that even in other countries where ADA compliance, for example, where we, for example, are doing some work in Mexico and the standards for people with disabilities are not as high as here. Living Building Challenge projects anywhere in the world have to meet the minimum of ADA compliance or better. And so what we're really trying to do is ensure that people with mobility issues also have equal access. There's actually even a few more things that we could talk about around equity, but it's important to raise these issues in the context of green building because it's about people as well as it's about the natural environment.
Would you like to go on and discuss those other issues surrounding equity?
Well, what we could talk about is this idea of access to nature, which is another element of our equity pedal, and we call our categories pedals in our program. But one of the requirements of a project, if a project is near a natural waterway, for example, it has to actually provide access to the waterway for anyone. And the reason why I bring this up is that, as you probably know, a lot of communities, especially here in the United States, lakes, rivers, waterfronts are owned by just a few people. And it's really sad when you have a community and it's very hard for people to actually get to the water's edge. And so we actually believe that it's a universal right to have access to that kind of natural system. And so if a property is on a waterfront edge, it actually has to provide access for anyone to that waterfront. So in the equity pedal, we have issues again about access for people with disabilities. We have issues of materials and the health impacts and where that ends up. We have issues of rights to nature, rights to fresh air, solar rights. These are things that are not in other green building standards, and we think they're important.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jason McLennan, CEO of the Cascadia Green Building Council and also the International Living Building Institute. Our topic is the Living Building Challenge, and you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Another aspect of your Living Building Challenge is stated to be that the building should be beautiful and inspiring to its inhabitants. Would you like to comment on that criterion?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. In the Living Building Challenge, we have primarily a bunch of very measurable performance requirements, but we also include some things that are not easily measured. And among those are issues of equity, as we talked about. Some of them are hard to measure. And also this issue of beauty and good design. And again, this is something that's not found in any other green program, but we actually think that sometimes in life, the things that are hard to measure, or maybe even impossible to measure, can sometimes be just as important or more important than the things that we can measure. But we have a tendency in our society, if we can't measure something, to treat it as zero, as having no value. And we think that that distorts the conversation. So we've introduced in the Living Building Challenge a pedal for beauty and inspiration. And the idea being that while we're not going to sit here and tell you whether your project is beautiful enough, it's not a beauty contest, we want to know what the intention was for the designers and for the project owners. What is the intention to create a wonderful place for people? So on one hand, it's one of the easier elements of the program to reach, but on the other hand, we need to make sure that this issue of good design and beauty is being addressed. And it's interesting that even though beauty is not easy to measure, we know that it has measurable impacts. For example, when a building is not well loved by its occupants, we find that those buildings are not properly maintained. They're not taken care of as well because there's no emotional connection. People don't love their building. And when you don't properly maintain something, it uses more energy, it uses more resources. And that has real environmental impact and economic impact. So beauty has this link to performance. And the other thing that I'll mention for those that are interested in preservation is that while certainly we have demolished too many of our beautiful historic buildings, we do tend to save and preserve the buildings where there has been a real attention to detail, where there has been real craftsmanship, where there is beauty present. And so we know that beautiful buildings tend to endure, and we need our buildings to endure. We don't want buildings that are built and merely torn down after 30 years or 40 years because nobody sees any value in them. All the material and energy that went into creating that building is then lost.
Would you now say more about the process by which an architect signs up for the Living Building Challenge and whether you have input during the design and those sorts of issues?
Sure. Actually, registering for our process is fairly simple. People go to our website, ilbi.org. They click a button that basically says, do you want to join our community? They join our community. It's a very small fee to join our community. We are a nonprofit. And once in the community, they have access to register a project, and they have access to research we've done and tools, and access to something called the dialogue site, which is a way we interact with project teams now all over the world. And they talk about, you know, what questions do they have pertaining to their project or their climate, and how does our program relate to their particular situation. So we have potentially a very interactive process with teams pursuing the Living Building Challenge, if they want. We also have teams that don't ask a lot of questions for some reason until they're ready to certify.
What types of architects tend to sign up?
Well, really right now, it's the leading thinkers, the leading designers and practitioners. Project teams typically that have already been through several LEED buildings, for example. These are teams that have considerable green building experience. They're not new at this. They're not afraid of challenges, and it is a challenge, and they're ready to further distinguish their work, and they're ready to push the environmental performance of their projects to an even better level. It's the leaders right now that are doing this, the early adopters.
Would you now put your Living Building Challenge in the context of the LEED standard and also the 2030 challenge, both of which
Sure.
are architectural challenges out there?
Yeah, and actually, interestingly enough, the Living Building Challenge, the word building is actually a verb for us. So we actually will certify landscape projects. We will certify community scale developments, renovations of existing buildings, streets, parks, bridges. So it's actually a living building standard for any type of building. So it really is more than just architecture, which many people don't realize because we started with buildings. That said, how does it relate to LEED? It's a very different system than LEED. We have a lot of projects that are using both protocols for different reasons. It doesn't compete with LEED in that it's doing a very different thing. It is a much more stringent standard. It's harder to achieve. Living buildings have a much, well, it's really the most stringent standard in the world. So it goes further than LEED Platinum by a considerable extent. But again, it's tackling a different sector of the market, if you will. LEED is kind of pushing the market forward. We're pulling from the top. So they're different. LEED is a bit more prescriptive and we're more performance-based. Our standard is based on actual performance, which is also different than any other program. So projects that go through the protocol, they have to be built and operated for a minimum of 12 months through a full year before we'll even certify, because we want to make sure that projects are really performing as they say they are. That's really important when you're calling a building a living building, that they actually perform the way they say they are. So it's very hard, but really quite an achievement when a project does it.
Would you also say how the Living Building Challenge relates to the 2030 Challenge,
oh,
which
sure.
of course is focused more on climate change
yeah.
specifically?
Well, sure, and we're big supporters of both LEED and the 2030 Challenge. We were one of the first to endorse the 2030 Challenge when it came out, and they us. Same with the U.S. Green Building Council, they actually endorse the Living Building Challenge. And in Canada, Canada Green Building Council helps us operate the Living Building Challenge and LEED. So it's really a great relationship. Now, the 2030 Challenge, one of the things that's interesting is if you do a living building, you immediately comply with the 2030 Challenge requirements. So we like that. They like that. Because again, we're pushing buildings further than ever before. Now, what we say is even though climate change is perhaps the biggest overall global challenge that we're facing, we know that there are other significant challenges related to water, to toxics in the environment, to habitat and species loss. And we take a viewpoint that you have to be holistic when you're doing these things, and that sometimes if you only focus on one issue, other problems pop up in other areas. And so it's not a criticism in any way of the 2030 challenge, because we do need programs that are targeting that issue. But our program really is holistic, and it's looking at all the issues together and trying to say, what's the ideal place to reach in all these areas?
Would you comment on how a living building interacts with the community around it? You've alluded a bit to that, but would you say more?
Well, one of the ways, we have one of our imperatives, which is our inspiration, beauty and inspiration. And as part of the inspiration requirements, Living Building Challenge projects have to share, and they have to educate, and they have to have elements of the project, interpretive elements, that help people around them understand, why is this building special? What is its environmental footprint? And we hope that this is a very active way that communities are engaged, not only in person, because there is interpretive signage required as part of this, but also they have to have a web presence, and they have to share the story, if you will, of their project electronically, so people anywhere can learn and share from this. And we know that these projects, because of their nature, that the design teams doing this are trying to find very special ways to connect with their communities and to reach out and use these projects as a catalyst for greater change. Again, we view each living building project as kind of a lighthouse or a beacon for the whole community to say, hey, this is possible now. We've done it in our community, and that means others can do it too, and kind of blaze a trail for more projects to follow.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jason McLennan, CEO of the Cascadia Green Building Council and the International Living Building Institute. Our topic is the Living Building Challenge. What kind of response are you getting from other architects and the industry in general?
Well, it's actually been really heartwarming to see the response. When we launched the program in 2006, we didn't know what we were going to get. And almost immediately, we got a huge amount of interest from architects and building owners and institutions all over North America. We now have currently over 70 registered projects. We just last week certified the world's first living buildings, which was a real milestone for the green building industry. One is a project in upstate New York, which is an amazing project. Another one is in Missouri. And then there was a house just outside of Victoria that almost got all of our requirements. And it can actually claim to be the greenest house out there. So we actually have three world's firsts in this last week. And the amount of media coverage we're getting for these projects is just fantastic. I mean, there's many ways we judge sort of how we're doing in terms of getting the word out, and in terms of hits to our website, in terms of requests to come present in different places. And we have projects now emerging in France and Australia, Mexico, Ireland. You know, we just this last summer launched the Irish Living Building Institute. We have a core group of passionate practitioners in, starting in Dublin and in Belfast, that are spreading the word in Ireland and beyond. So when we start having that reach in other countries, you know that the idea is going viral.
Would you pick one of the projects that you mentioned that's been certified and just describe it?
Yeah, the one that I would mention is the one I just visited last week for an award ceremony, and that's this project in New York. It's called the Omega Center, and it's in Rhinebeck, New York. In Rhinebeck, there is this retreat center that's been around since the late 60s, called Omega. And it's a large campus, 195-acre campus, that has tons of buildings. People go there for educational retreats and healing retreats. And all these buildings used to be on septic systems, and these septic systems were failing and starting to pollute the groundwater. And so they knew they had to do something about this, so they decided to build their own ecological waste treatment plant. And this waste treatment plant, they wanted to make a living building. And they knew that it was going to be so special that they decided to build a classroom into the waste treatment plant. And so this waste treatment plant is unlike any you've seen probably before. It's such a beautiful, inspiring facility where they actually do yoga in the waste treatment plant. And I encourage the people to breathe deeply there. It doesn't smell. It has no chemicals being used to treat the water. It has beautiful plants and butterflies flying around, and the sun streaming into this building, a constructed wetlands outside. Again, it will never have an energy bill. It'll never have a water bill. It generates all of its energy from the sun on site. It collects water from multiple buildings, treats the water without chemicals, with no fossil fuel use, and then integrates that clean water back into the landscape. People go there and they feel like they're in a cathedral, even though it's for treating human waste. And what a shift in paradigms. And if we could imagine that all of our public infrastructure, even something as lowly as a sewage treatment plant, could become a community treasure, could become a place where people go and they want to do yoga in it because it's so profound. That is the future of our civilization. So our tax dollars are not being spent on something we want to hide that is a burden on us, something that is a benefit to us. And long term, it's the cheapest solution. So what an investment.
What has been the response to the Living Building Challenge here in Seattle?
Seattle is great. This is a very progressive community. You have probably here in Seattle and, you know, definitely in Portland and Vancouver as well, the sort of the highest per capita concentration of green thinkers. We're just really lucky to have some great people. And not surprisingly, we have in our region, in the Cascadia region, we have more living building projects per capita than anywhere else. Unfortunately, we weren't first, but we have some great projects here in the Seattle area. We have schools and community centers, and the Cascadia Center that the Bullitt Foundation is doing is a really exciting project because it's in Capitol Hill, a multi-story project. I think is really going to be an important project for this city. There's just so many great projects that are emerging, and we can't talk about all of them because some of them are private until they're ready to announce it. But Seattle is really supportive. And we even have, through the city of Seattle, a pilot ordinance where the city of Seattle is encouraging pilot projects to become living buildings and providing expedited permitting and other incentives to encourage people to move to this level in innovation. So we're seeing leaderships at the city level. We're seeing leadership at the county level through King County. They have a great program at the King County with Green Tools. And they're highly supportive of the Living Building Challenge. And on and on. Seattle is a great place to be launching an idea like this.
What would you predict as the date for the first certified living building in Seattle?
Well, I expect that we will have the first living building that is going for it in the end of 2011. And then because it takes 12 months, I think it's in 2012 we're going to have the first certified living building in Seattle.
What are the economics of a living building?
Well, you know, money is an interesting thing. People always want to know, well, what does this cost? Is this like really expensive? Is it going to cost us three times as much? And so that was an issue that we knew we had to tackle head first when we started this. Now, pretty early on, we got a wonderful grant from the Russell Family Foundation, who supports many great environmental programs throughout the Puget Sound area. And they funded us to basically answer this question, what are the long-term and immediate economic benefits of doing this? And so we did a big financial study of nine different building types in four different climate zones to look at cost premiums up front and paybacks. And the results were fascinating. And we have the summary of this on our website for people to see. And all the numbers are transparent so people can look at our assumptions. But the cost premiums, and it does cost more when you have your own energy utility and essentially your own water utility, but not as much as people expected in all the scenarios. It's never twice the cost, not even close. In fact, the range of premiums range from the low end of 4-9% to the high end of about 40% more first cost. Now, 40% more first cost might sound like a lot. It's certainly not twice the cost, but imagine never having an energy bill and never having a water bill, and what that does to your long-term economics. And so we found the payback time is much lower as well. And so what we did find is that any institution, I think if you're going to do community building, a community center, a university or community college building, any kind of project where you're holding on to your assets for any amount of time, the only smart economic choice, in my opinion, is to do living buildings, especially with potentially rising energy costs in the future that could rise very rapidly. This is actually a very smart economic thing to do, and it's partly why we are seeing so much adoption of this standard, because if this was too expensive, nobody would do it.
What seem to be the greatest difficulties to overcome in meeting the Living Building Challenge?
Well, there still are obviously some economic barriers for some, especially in the recession. there is an issue for some of cost. And then there are some code and regulatory barriers, primarily around water. We have some very antiquated viewpoints around water in this country, really kind of 100-year-old thinking around water and waste. And so a lot of what we promote is not always at first accepted by the regulatory community. So we're seeing projects having to get pilot exemptions and changing the codes. So most of the barriers that we see are either economic, although those are smaller than people think, and diminishing rapidly, or they're regulatory around water. Otherwise, the barriers are just educational in nature or attitudinal, people thinking that they can't do this. But in fact, we know they can.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think there is a few things I'd like to say. The first is that we need to have a sense of urgency about transforming our built environment, that buildings and our communities play a huge role in the environmental challenges that we're facing. And so the solutions there have a huge ability to create the kind of future that we're looking for. But we have to make the changes now. There's a tendency to always want to wait for new technologies to be invented or wait for someone else to sort of save us. And what we like to encourage people is whatever you're doing in terms of the built environment now, if you're renovating your home, if you're changing your office out, you're building a new building, it's time to think about going to the level of a living building. And don't assume that you can't do it or you can't afford it. There's a chance for you to be a leader in pushing the boundaries of environmental performance.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jason.
It's great to be here.
You have just been listening to Jason McLennan, CEO of the Cascadia Green Building Council and also the International Living Building Institute, speak about the Living Building Challenge. For more information, check on the web at www.ilbi.org. Again, that's ilbi.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.